Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, we visit with Mr. Larry Clark, Kentucky Farm Bureau's second vice president. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
How's David and Vicki this morning?
I'm getting along.
David's got a big pile of cough drops packed up in front of him there.
I'm struggling, but I am making it through, hopefully.
It might be a long morning.
It may be. You may be right.
You definitely have more than you normally have.
Yes. I felt better in my lifetime than I do right now, but we'll muddle through anyway.
There's something to be said about being prepared, though.
That's right. That's right.
And you are prepared.
I am.
We're in Louisville, Kentucky this morning at the Kentucky Farm Bureau State offices, and they've been kind enough to let us come in and set up shop, and over the past couple of days recorded a lot of shows that will be
really
aired,
good ones.
Throughout the January and February, and I think we'll make some really, really good content for folks.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Appreciate Renee Laurent. Renee Carrico.
Carrico.
I'm going to get it right one of these days. When I filled out the paperwork to come in yesterday, I put Laurent, just like I've known that, and I have known that youngin since she was a little bitty thing, but I will get it right, Renee Carrico, and we appreciate all that she did to help us get set up for our podcast, and she took care of a schedule and everything, and the only thing we had to do was show up with her stuff, and it's been a really good really good couple of days so far.
She's been a tremendous host, that's for sure.
Yep.
When you don't work in a studio, per se, which we don't, we're all over everywhere, setting these shows up and kind of being a voice for agriculture and for extension. To have somebody go through that process of setting everybody up, getting notes made, it was a tremendous help to making these shows come off without a hitch.
She's really spoiled us.
She really has. And, you know, I'm kind of like Jay was talking yesterday. We may have to start making everybody give us some talking points like she has gotten together for everybody. But it's made things really smooth and very, you know, it's flowed really good. And, you know, I'm looking forward to today and visiting today. So,
and another shout out to the folks here at the Kentucky Farm Bureau building that we are in and allowing us to come in here. And it's a beautiful facility, beautiful building. And we appreciate Renee took us on a tour yesterday afternoon after we finished recording. She took us on a tour and was able to talk to some of the communication folks down there and they showed us the new studio.
Yeah, that was really neat.
Just very nice, and it was.
I told them it looked just like our equipment.
And I followed that with, something like that.
I don't know about y'all. They had more toys than I could play down there.
That was really nice.
There was a lot of screens and a lot of buttons. Yeah. And
And he turned it on and kind of, you know, pulled up all the different camera angles and all that stuff. And, gosh, it was really neat. And,
yeah, it was.
A lot of respect for those folks that know how to operate that machinery. It's too much. Too many buttons for me, and I for sure couldn't handle all that. For
me
sure,
either.
So.
Absolutely. You know, Renee set us up a lot of different guests for us to make these shows with, and she set up us up with a guest this morning.
Yeah.
Newly minted second vice president of Kentucky Farm Bureau, Mr. Larry Clark from Greene County. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Yeah. I'm looking at your notes here, and I see member of Greasy Creek Baptist Church.
Yes, sir.
Is that in the big city of Exie?
That's in the big city of Exie.
You've heard of a sandbagger?
I'm
going to let you in on a little secret. I was born in Greensburg.
Right.
Grew up in Campbellsville. Okay. And I think you and I have a mutual friend and a guy by the name of Bob Olt.
We do. Absolutely.
Bob's been somebody that I've known for a long time, a lot of years. First knew him as a VOAG teacher and being involved with showing dairy cattle at the State Fair. I've worked State Fair Dairy Show for my whole career, and I've got to know both of his kids, Stephen and Amy, real well. And I've got friends and family all over Greensburg, so Greene County. So glad to have you here with us this morning.
Well, it's good to be here with you guys. And Bob Olt was my ag teacher when I was in high school, and we had a lot of fun with Bob Olt and learned a lot of stuff. Actually, Bob Olt may be the reason I'm here today, to tell you the truth. He got me out in the world and taught me a lot of things about leadership and dealing with people and just getting out and doing stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I owe a lot of that to Bob.
Yeah.
You know, that's FFA. I mean, you said that was your ag teacher. Is that what you said? You know, we've talked to a lot of people over the last 2 years that we had guests on here for our podcast, and I cannot tell you how many of the guests, actually most of them, if not all, really, have been involved in either 4-H or FFA.
Right.
And all of us that went through high school and was a part of those organizations, it really does prepare you to be a leader in your community, and it really gives you a good base to, and it really pushes us in out of our comfort zones, because if you're going to be an FFA, you're gonna learn to talk. You're gonna have to get up in front of people and speak. You're gonna have to do the creed. You're gonna have to do different contests that forces you to push you out of that comfort zone. But boy, it gives us all a good, I mean, it gets us off to a really good start and a good foundation for when we get out of high school and go into college or our careers.
Absolutely. I'll ask this real quick because I see where you go to church. Do you know Lana Houck?
I do.
All right. That's a cousin of mine.
She lives just down below me a little bit.
Okay.
Probably about 3 miles from me.
Okay.
Lana and Dale do. So.
Yeah. My mother grew up in Greene County, Greene and Taylor County some, but both my grandparents were of Greene County. Grandmother was from that Exe area, actually. She was a Hudgens. And my grandfather was from the Gabe community.
Right.
Out above Summersville, so.
Well, you don't know never know who you're going to run into, do you?
Hey, if you talk to Jay very long, he finds something, he knows where the little places are to eat or the churches he knows somebody almost in every community. Well, I can't even just say Kentucky. I mean, you can.
It goes out
of Kentucky. You can talk about Tennessee. Well, yesterday they about Tennessee and.
We were talking about Mr. Ricky Arnett before you got here this morning, and your county extension agent, and Jay commenced to telling us where he was from. Where he lived. That part of the country, he's very familiar with y'all's area.
Ricky, he's a very good friend of mine. Thank a lot of him, and he does a really good job there leading our county in agriculture and good support for us there.
So, absolutely.
He's on the Kentucky Farm Bureau board.
He is.
And, he does a fine job for our KACAA organization.
Right. Yes, he does.
Yeah, he's very interested and very knowledgeable about that stuff.
He's
good people.
That's exactly what I was going to say, just good people.
I agree.
Tell us just a little bit about your farming operation. Now, you go to church in Exe. I'm assuming you live somewhere in and around that area?
I do live about 2 miles from the church, I guess.
Okay. You said you lived near my cousin, so that'd be right.
Yeah, so we farm there in the Exe community of Greene County, a little bit in Metcalf County and a little bit in Adair County, but mostly in Greene County there in the southern end of the county. And we had 180 acres of tobacco, burley tobacco this year. We have about 375 head of cattle and about 900 to 1,000 acres of grain, corn, soybeans, wheat. Mm-hmm. And of course, we put up some hay and stuff. So we run about 2,000 acres, I guess.
Yeah. You got some barns and curing structures right there on 68.
We do. Either most of them you see there will be mine or one of my cousins along 68.
I've wondered whose those were through the years as I was going back and forth through there. So kind of know the location there.
Yeah. So I may get to use more of them this year. My cousin says he's not going to grow anymore, so I'm talking to him about leasing some of them. So.
Yeah. Now, who's your cousin?
Wilcoxon, Jimmy Wilcoxon.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
180 acres of tobacco.
Yes, ma'am.
That's a lot.
That's a lot, yeah.
I don't care how you say that. That's a lot.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I'm assuming you use H2A labor.
I do. Okay. We had 20 H2A laborers this year, and they do a good job. Most of them do, you know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you run into ones not too good like Americans, but
yep.
Sure.
Yep. Now, have you kept the same pretty well throughout? I worked on a farm there in Tree County that, and we had anywhere from 25 to 30. And a lot of them were the same guys. There was a core group of about 8 or 10 that had come ever since they started. So have you using kind of the same ones that you've started with?
Yes, we do have that core group that's probably around 10 or 12 that's mm-hmm. been coming for a long time. And
yeah.
we have some new ones come about every year, and about half of them work out. The other half
don't
yep. work out, you yep. know. So yep. some of them are... don't want to do some of the labor we have to do, you know. So.
Well, that's I've noticed that they kind of police themselves, you know. And
they do.
And if you're not carrying your weight, you don't get to come back next year.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
right.
kind of the way they do it. And,
yeah. My head Mexican came to me this year, and, you know, he said, this guy needs to go home. He was 19 years old.
Yeah.
And
yep.
I said, well, let's try to train him, you know. We got to get somebody mm-hmm. trained to do this work. So.
Right.
He wasn't trainable, I don't think, so he finally had to go home. So,
yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just like everything else. You know, there's good ones and there's bad ones. And
right.
With everybody, I mean, it doesn't matter. You
right.
know?
It's hard work, and, mm-hmm. you know, a 19-year-old that hadn't ever done that before, it's
a rude awakening.
It is.
It really is. I mean, and especially being from Mexico, you know, you don't have a lot of that type of labor. That,
right.
You know, you don't have a lot of tobacco, so you don't really have any concept of how hard that work is. And you know, I've told people many times that's some of the hardest work that I ever did.
Sure.
Was
right.
cutting tobacco. Mm-hmm. And,
it is. Yeah.
You know, probably the closest for those that have had a chance to do that would be some of the produce type farms.
Right.
If they've worked in and around them. Yeah. Still comparing that to a tobacco patch, and even differently a tobacco barn.
Right.
Is probably a different world than most of them's ever had a chance to be yeah. in. But the one thing that I wished a lot of people knew about our H-2A migrant workers that do come into the country is mm-hmm. most of them do want to work.
They
most
do.
Of them come yeah. here and want to work. Just like us, they're trying to better themselves. They're trying to provide for their families back home. And that's really, a different spin on it that a lot of people don't think about when they marry that up with hard work is there's still some people out there that want to work.
Right, yeah. there is. Mm-hmm. My head guy there that comes every year, it's been coming for about 20 years. He sent his sister through college because he had money to do that with, you know.
Right.
And they all just send money home all the time mm-hmm. to take care of their families and all.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of times it looks like we may be, with my 15 to 20 workers, we may be feeding about 60 people in Mexico with that.
Right. Absolutely.
Yep.
That's a big difference for them. And
I had one that worked with a producer in Christian County years ago that I dealt with there for a few different summers because we were doing some tobacco trials, some research plots with this producer. In Mexico, the rest of the year, he was a school teacher.
Yeah.
But come over here every year to just to work that time of putting in the crop, and then we'd go back home. So that's to hear him tell it he could do as well in those 3 months here as he did throughout the rest of the year.
Oh yeah,
in Mexico.
That's right.
So
yeah.
I have some that stay here from April till Christmas, you know, mm-hmm. every year, and because yep. they make what they call a lot of money, you know,
sure
in
mm-hmm.
that time, so
mm-hmm.
they can do a lot of help. And some of them built houses in Mexico since they started
yeah,
working for me.
Sure,
you
yeah,
know, they
yeah.
just.
How long has it been, or when did you start, you know, having H-2A workers?
It's probably about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I built them a new bunkhouse there about 20 years ago, and we've been having them ever since. Getting ready to I'm going to remodel the bunkhouse this winter while they're
yeah.
gone. So
yeah.
They helped me get prepared to do that before
yeah.
they left. And
yeah.
Yeah, they're looking forward to coming back to a remodeled bunkhouse in the spring.
Sure.
So.
You know, if you've ever sat down and talked with them any, which and I did, I had the opportunity to do that, and to hear them tell about the conditions that are in Mexico that they came from, you would understand why they're here and trying to work to make a better living
sure.
for their family. I mean, a lot of them have their parents living with them. And some of them have their grandparents living with them. So they're providing for, like Mr. Clark said, you know, for all of these people that are in Mexico. And, you know, just to hear some of the stories, you know, the head guy there, his name was Louis, And Louie was telling me that at night they would go in, because he said the cartels would come out with their guns and stuff and go up and down the street and want to know why you were out and
right.
some different things like that. So listening to their story, you would understand why they're here.
I mean, right.
they would.
Yeah, they when they get ready to go home, they don't want to pack any money on them, because when they're on their way home, the cartel stops them mm-hmm. and, you know, tries to find their money.
Yep.
And, you know, yep. it's just not safe to carry mm-hmm. money on you when you're headed home.
So. Let me ask yeah. this. I've known a lot of producers that had the opportunity to go to Mexico and visit some of their guys. Have you ever had a chance to do that?
I've not been down there and done that yet. I would like to go sometime and visit yep. them in Mexico.
I've known a few that I've worked with through the years well, that took those chances to do yeah. that, and they said it was really eye-opening when you get yep. to go to their homes and
right.
see some of those conditions compared
you know,
to here.
I had said something to Louie about doing that same thing, and he said, I'd rather you not. He said, I'm afraid something would happen to you.
Right.
You mm-hmm. know, because you're a foreigner and they're, you know, in their neck of the woods, and you know, he said, I would be scared that something would happen. And
yeah.
He said, you know, if you just came like for a day and then went back, then that he said, but for as far as like staying, he said, no.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. so he would be scared. So that's a, you know, certainly a, you know, you would like to see their living conditions and how they live, but then, you know, if they're scared for you, I mean, I'm right. good with not going, you know,
right.
I believe what they tell me. So, you know, we talk a little bit about when we've talked on this program about the H-2A situation and some even some of the wage rates that we're seeing now. You know, what are some of your opinions on, you know, some of these the wage rates that they're going up? And then I had one of my producers was telling me he had some folks that come from South Africa, and he said they were talking about having to keep up with different rates of time. Like when they're driving a truck, it's one rate. And if they're doing manual labor, it's another rate. You know, what are your thoughts on some of those problems with the H-2A program?
Well, if the wage rates keep going up, we're going to have to get more for our product because, yeah. You know, that's a big impact on mm-hmm. If we make a profit or not. And
sure.
The $24 an hour versus the $15 an hour, you know, for the driver,
mm-hmm.
you know, we don't know how DOL is going to rule on that. So it's got a lot of producers scared about what's going to happen. And
yep.
if they come in and rule, we've got to pay everybody $24 an hour. You know, we're just up the creek.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, it's very concerning about where we're headed with it. And that's mm-hmm. one reason that my cousin had decided to quit because that very reason right there.
Mm-hmm. And, right.
We don't know where that's headed, and yep. it's very concerning. So,
yep.
And farm labor is just such a problem across the board. And certainly in tobacco, that intensive labor, and it's an issue. But it's mm-hmm. also farm labor is an issue for grain production, and you'd already mentioned, you know, in vegetable production. But it's just an issue. And trying to find good labor and dependable labor at a fair rate for both sides is getting harder and harder and harder.
It is.
There's a lot of folks that's farming that just – I think what you just said, I think it's one of those things. Sometimes you just throw your hands up and say, well, if I can't get the labor, I can't do it.
Right. We have a custom lime hauling business, and my lime truck's been in the shed about all year because I couldn't find enough labor to run it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just yeah. left it sitting. So, and I have my two sons, you know, they're getting ready to get into some kind of a business, and mm-hmm. we're trying to figure out whether they need to stick with this tobacco or go a different route yeah. because mm-hmm. we don't know where their back is at, and,
right.
and
sure.
if we're going to be able to get labor at a reasonable rate. And so yeah. we're kind of looking at chickens and mm-hmm. different things, laying house or something.
You know, that brings up a good point. The tobacco business in general has changed a lot in the last 15 years. I know what tobacco meant to the central part of the state at one time. Tell us just a little bit about tobacco in your operation now and what still being able to raise that crop means to you as a farmer.
Well, because when I started out farming, you know, my dad, he had the most he ever had was 3 acres of tobacco, I guess. 3 acres of tobacco, 20, 25 cows, and about 10 acres of corn. And he raised us on that and and done good, you know, paid for everything and did real well. But, you know, today I'm raising 180 acres of tobacco and may not be doing as good as he did with 3 acres back then.
That's right. I mean, it has changed so much. And we've said before on this podcast that tobacco was a way to, it paid for so many college educations. It paid for cars. It paid for, and I've said this about my own brother, too. You know, my dad farmed. His dad was in the farming operation. But for my brother to come in, tobacco was a part of that. That was one of the reasons he could start farming full time is because of the tobacco. Because he was working with my dad and his brother. But tobacco was such a mainstay, I guess you could say, on farms for so many different reasons. And it was smaller acreages. It wasn't 180 acres. It was. I mean, I can remember somebody having 5 acres, and I thought, my goodness, that's a lot of tobacco.
Right. And glad I'm not hipping in.
Ain't that the truth? I didn't like that chopping out business or pulling plants. That was my job as a youngin', as David says. You know, I remember pulling plants and setting tobacco and chopping it out and working in tobacco. And it's not the same world anymore.
It's not. It's changed a lot in my lifetime, you know. Well, I've set tobacco with a peg before, so I'm glad that changed.
My first job was toting plants for my grandfather who reset behind the setter.
I had to walk behind the setter some myself.
Yeah, we don't do much resetting anymore. We do a little bit, but not a whole lot. But anyway, every part of it's changed a lot since I can first remember, and probably the baling has changed, you know, the stripping and baling, you know, putting it in, went from hand tying to now we're in the big bale and goes so much faster than it did. We strip more tobacco in a day than my dad used to raise.
Isn't that amazing? It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable, really.
Remember sitting stripping tobacco and tying hands, and I mean, it felt like it took forever. And we never did. The most we ever had was 5 acres, and I thought, well, I was going to die the year we had 5 acres. But, when I was a kid, I mean, I was little. I was probably 10 or 11, you know, in that ballpark. But, you know, we would strip on Saturdays, and every chance that we had, we'd strip tobacco, you know, at night and a lot of those times. And I won't take anything for that. A lot of good memories doing that, but things have come so far in such a short period of time, or it feels like a short period of time to me, you know, from the way we used to do tobacco.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, back then it all had to be real straight, and you know, the ends, ends even on the hands. And
my grandfather would get with you if you didn't do it right.
My dad would too.
Well, but that spoke to the pride that had in the crop that they were raising, and they knew what it meant for it to be presented as such when it went to the market.
That's right. They had a lot of pride in it back then. And I remember when we went to the small bales, you know, I told my dad, I said, we're going to buy some baler boxes and start baling. He said, I'm not buying them baler boxes. You're going to have to. So, you know, he wasn't really fond of that. But, that was a big step there from hand tying. And then we went from there to just throwing it all in there, every which way, I guess.
Right. I can remember when I was a little kid, booking. We had dark fire tobacco. And I remember my grandfather booking, and he'd take every hand, and he'd handle every hand, and it had to be just so, and book it down in the barn. And then when you took it up and put it on the wagon, you did the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and, I mean, there's a lot of labor involved in tobacco back in the old days, I guess you'd say.
Carrying that through to the auction house.
Yeah.
Producers went with that crop and made sure it was unloaded and presented just the same way that it went on that wagon.
Yeah. we had to put our own tobacco on the basket so it would mm-hmm. look right. You
That's
know?
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, he wanted it looking just right for them buyers.
Yeah.
Of course, at the time when we had local markets like that, you had markets in Greensburg.
We did.
I worked in the warehouse in Richmond, Kentucky, when I was in college. So you learned the producers that just soon you unload it and handle it, and you knew the ones that come in and wanted to handle it the way they wanted to handle it, you know, and you, right. you didn't mishandle it. No, they might have let you do it, but you didn't mishandle
yeah.
it.
You might have to fix it someday.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, go ahead, Vicki.
You currently serve on as the chair of the Kentucky Farm Bureau Tobacco Advisory Council. Is that
yes,
is that correct?
Ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
So just talk a little bit about that advisory council and what you all do and the, kind of the purpose of that council.
Well, the purpose of it, I guess, is to find out, you know, and learn what we need to be doing to make the tobacco industry better. And there's people on that council scattered all over the state. You know, it comes in and meets with us all the way from West Kentucky to East Kentucky. And mm-hmm. We meet a couple of times a year, three times. Some of us meet more than that, but the whole council meets a couple of times a year.
Yeah.
And just come up with ideas that might make the tobacco better, or might make the, you know, just labor better. We talk about labor, of course, in tobacco mm-hmm. meetings and all. So chemicals we might use and mm-hmm. Just anything that might mm-hmm. better the program, you know.
Yeah. So,
and that's, I'm assuming that's probably a place, too, that you can talk about these issues that you all are facing and maybe some ways to offset those issues or try to hit those issues head on to make it
right.
better for you, for those growers.
Right. We come up with the resolutions for the Resolution Committee here at Farm Bureau, and hopefully those get sent on to Frankfort or Washington, and some of those ideas will get into law that, you know, mm-hmm. that will make better for any of our producers.
Well, it's important to have leaders in those councils and those leaders in the communities across the state, and because the whole, you're not just representing one segment or one part of Kentucky. You're representing, like you said, from one end to the other, and have representation on that council from across the state to make sure that everybody's voice is heard and to try to make it better for everybody. And
well, you know, the good thing about it is, just like Mr. Clark has a lot of experience in tobacco.
Yes.
I think that's something that we miss in Washington these days, is
right.
people that have agricultural experience, and it's getting that way in Frankfort, probably, I'm guessing.
More every day.
Yeah, you know, so having people that have experience with these commodities or with these problems, I mean, that makes such a big difference to know what you're talking about, and you can lend some validity to the problem because you've seen it firsthand.
Right. And on a committee, you get to listen to the problems all across the state. You know, they might have a problem in West Kentucky that I don't have in Central Kentucky, and we get to learn. You learn a lot of stuff mm-hmm. at those meetings, and so it's very educational, and hopefully we make a difference somewhere.
Absolutely.
Know, down yeah. the line.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I've reading through the notes here that Renee give us, and I see where you've been involved with your local cattlemen's association, past yeah. Farm Bureau president, things like that. Talk to us just a little bit about where any of those roles kind of began. How did you first become involved with Farm Bureau?
Well, it's been close to 30 years ago, I guess. A young man there in our county that was on the Farm Bureau board come and asked me if I would be interested in sitting on the county Farm Bureau board, and I thought that was you know, that would be such an honor to be able to sit on the Farm Bureau board there in our county, and never did I ever dream that I'd be sitting here today when that happened. But anyway, it was an honor to sit there on the Farm Bureau board. I've learned a lot through the years on the board. I was president for 17 years, vice president for 4 years, mm-hmm. and it's been an amazing experience, and I'm still on the board there, so
yep.
I enjoy working with Farm Bureau and all the guys and gals in Farm Bureau. So.
you know, there's quite a bit of difference between local board activity and the State Farm Bureau, but everything that goes on at the state level starts at the county level.
It does.
What are some of the issues that your county board may have faced that y'all worked on together locally that you've seen throughout your time there?
Well, we had to build a building, of course, and you know that's everybody has different ideas about that. So we worked through all those and got them all worked out, and everybody's glad we did that and got a nice building, you know. And, there and just different issues comes up, you know, that everybody don't have the same opinion about that.
Yeah,
you know, you just have to work with each other, and right. Whenever we get done, everybody works for the same purpose, and
yep.
We're here to make everything better.
Absolutely.
I think that's the great thing about Farm Bureau, and when you step back and take a look at how they handle the issues, you know, they come from the county and go through the resolutions committee, and then the resolutions committee passes that along to the at the annual meeting and into policy, and you know, if you don't necessarily agree with the resolutions committee, you have that opportunity to, it's a completely democratic process, right. And you have the opportunity to voice your opinion and get up and say what you think, if it's good, bad, or indifferent. You know, you have that opportunity, and I think that's the great thing about Farm Bureau. It is a grassroots organization. It comes from the bottom to the top.
Right. It all starts at the county farm bureaus, and, you know, like you say, if it don't get in the resolutions book, you know, you have the opportunity, if not at the state convention, next year you can try it again, you know. So
that's right.
It's a good process. It mm-hmm. comes from a simple, you know, yep. It don't start at the top. It comes from the bottom up. So
yep.
That's, you know, one of the things I felt like we've always had in common between the Cooperative Extension Service and Farm Bureau, cattlemen's associations. They're all grassroots level organizations. They all start with working on local issues and then work towards that bigger goal of solving things for across the state.
Right. That's
true. Yeah, I mean, I think there were a few things that came up on the floor of the meeting that weren't necessarily in the, that came through the resolutions committee. I think there were a few things, some wording and some different things that we voted on. I was a delegate for my county and had the opportunity to vote on whether we wanted to do that or not.
Right, you can bring it up on the floor.
Yeah.
You know, it's just everybody has an opportunity to
right.
get what they want in to be a resolution.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Mr. Clark, what are some things that you're looking forward to working with Farm Bureau kind of in the future? What are some things that you're looking forward to working with, or, you know, maybe some different organizations or different projects that you're looking forward to?
Well, I'm looking forward to doing something with labor. That's one of our top priorities now, and mm-hmm. hopefully we can get some headway on this labor deal, because we've been sitting still on it for a long time, and we're about to get desperate for some yep. different kind yep. of labor. So hopefully we can make a lot of progress in labor in the next couple of years, and
right.
and get that headed to where it's going to be better for everyone. And,
well, there are a lot of problems with labor right now, and we talked about it earlier. You know, the $24 compared to the $15, that'll just about break anybody that is using H-2A labor.
I mean, well, really, even outside of agriculture, labor is becoming an issue in yeah. every form of business yes. there is in this country.
Yeah.
I
don't know where all these people are at. You know, we used to not have this problem, but we've got this problem now. I think I know the answer, but I don't, you know, want to get into that. But, you know, we used to not have this problem.
I know.
And
yeah, it's with everybody. You know, my yeah. wife works for TJ Sampson in Glasgow, and, mm-hmm. you know, she has to hire people to work there. And they hire a lot of temporary help, you know, because they can't find local.
Yep.
And
yep.
have to pay a lot more to get it,
but, right? Mm-hmm. And it is an issue across all segments of every industry, really. I mean, my wife works at a hospital there in Paducah, and she has the same problem. She's head of a department. She has to hire folks, and she has trouble finding folks that right. can do, and it's kind of a specialized deal, but it's still hard to find people. Right. And you have to hire people that travel. They're traveling nurses, I guess, is what they're right. called, and they're a lot higher than other folks well, are, but it's a specialized kind of deal.
Similar to the H-2A program, when you have those travel your workers on contract, you're paying more than just their hourly wage.
That's
you're
right.
paying their travel expenses. You're paying some of their living expenses to to help keep them up and keep them along the way.
Right. Just the $14 an hour, $14.26 or whatever it was this year, you know, that's not near all of it. We have to pay their travel to get here, and then we furnish housing and and all the utilities and a vehicle for them to drive, and so it wounds up being $20-something an hour.
That's what I was fixing to say. Just probably guess a little over $20 an hour anyway.
Right. So.
And that's not going to change. I mean, you're still going to be paying that, even if that increase goes up to $24 an hour.
Right.
So.
Well, that's a valid cost of your production, and that's why you said earlier that if that keeps climbing, you're going to have more for your product.
That's right.
You know, that's the thing about an agricultural product is you don't get to just sit and hold it and sit on it until somebody pays you what you want. Yeah. You're at the mercy of the markets.
You can't eat it.
You
can't eat it.
Right.
Yeah.
You're at the mercy of the markets, but your cost, you don't have the ability to cap them either. Your cost of production keep rising every day, every year.
That's right. Yeah. So we don't have any control over it. So.
Right. I think I remember hearing this quote somewhere. I don't want to butcher it. I think it was John F. Kennedy said that the farmer buys at retail, sells at wholesale, and pays the shipping both ways.
Right.
I think is the quote I heard, and that's becoming more and more evident in this day and market age.
It is.
So, you know, we've talked a little bit about your past Farm Bureau experiences. David talked a little bit about the labor. What are some of the other aspirations that or goals that you might have set for yourself, or maybe that others have set for you in your new leadership role that you hope to accomplish?
Well, I've just started it, so I don't really know what all that's going to entail, I guess. So just looking forward to working with Eddie and Shane and all the staff here and learning new things. And
what was it about being in the position you are now? What was it that made you decide that you wanted to step out and maybe venture in this direction?
Well, like I said, you know, Bob Oak taught me a lot of the leadership skills I know. And, you know, I love being in leadership. And, you know, my faith is a whole lot. You know, I base my faith as a whole lot of my leadership. And, you know, if you don't have faith, and you know, it's hard to go out and do a lot of stuff. So
yes.
That's right.
I put my faith in God that He will take me through whatever I need to go through. And a lot of times we leave that out. And that's a very important part of my life is faith. And we go to church there at Greasy Creek, and my boys are there and my wife, and we are a big part of the church. And We enjoy going to church. It's not that we have to go to church every Sunday or Wednesday night or Sunday night, but we enjoy it. But you know, life is short, and sometimes we need to stop and realize where everything we got came from, and that is from God. And you know, I think I can show a lot of my faith-based stuff in this role, that I have faith, and most people do have faith, but we forget it sometimes, and where our life comes from, and what we're here for. And I think that, you know, we're here to make a difference in other people's lives, and in a leadership position like this, you know, I want you to feel good every day, you know.
Yep.
The people around me, I want to encourage you and encourage everyone I come in contact with and have a smile for everybody and a good word for them and try to make them feel better every day. And I think that that is part of my leadership role in this position is to, we have a lot of good people here at Farm Bureau, and we want to keep it that way, keep them feeling good. And
well, there is
very well said.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you described very well what an effective leader is. And and there's leaders and there's effective leaders, and there is a big difference. There's a big difference there.
Right.
And a lot of that, most of that comes from the reason behind why you want to be a leader, because you want to be a leader in, because you want to make a difference. You want to be a positive impact. You want to help others.
Yeah.
Nowhere in that description did it sound like you was doing that for you, for benefit of you, for a pat on your back. It's not about you.
Right.
And to me personally, that's when you really see effective leadership.
Yep.
That's right. Well, he said it best. We're called to help others. We're not called to be self-serving.
That's right.
And, and as long as you have a place to be grounded in that, that'll always be there for you to fall back on as you run through trials and tribulations at all levels of life.
That's right.
So,
We appreciate you stepping out into that role. And
absolutely.
And I'm certain that there was a part of you thinking, oh, I'm really going outside of my comfort zone here. It wouldn't be for me.
He may wish he was back in the tobacco patch.
He might. That's right. But
it's a long way from Exe right here.
But we do appreciate you being willing to serve in this leadership role. And
absolutely.
Because I know it's not a small undertaking. It's a big undertaking that you have stepped into, and and the time commitment that it takes to do the job that you're starting. You're just starting in that. And so on behalf of all of us, we wish you the very best in this role, and we're excited to see where this role takes you. Excited to be working with you some in the future. I'm sure our paths will cross many times, and but we do appreciate the work that you're going to be doing.
Thank you. It's an honor and a blessing to be here.
You know, sir, one of the things we always do towards the end of this show is we like to wrap things up with a timely tip. Sometimes it's relative to the subject matter that we're talking about. Sometimes it's relative to the actual time of the year that it is.
Right.
But we felt, looking at kind of your background and what brought you here today, we felt like a good timely tip to tell all of our listeners would be to remind everybody to get out and be an advocate for agriculture. And that first step is to get involved locally, whether it's your Cattlemen's Association, local Farm Bureau board, a cooperative extension, a county council, maybe a conservation district. There is enough roles locally, and we all have the same problem working in these organizations, and it's a good problem to have sometimes, but we have the same people serving on all our boards, and we're at the risk of using up our leadership. Folks like you, and I'm sure you've done this, you might have that person that you've gone out and encouraged to step into a role, just like somebody did you years ago.
Right.
I hope you have.
I hope
so. We've all been the benefit of somebody doing that at some point in time, and we just felt like that would be a good timely tip today, is to remind everybody to get out, be an advocate for agriculture, and to get started locally at your local level.
Right. We need all the good leaders we can get in the local level.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, we appreciate you being here with us today. We want to thank Mr. Clark for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.